Welcome to the Forum Storytellers Podcast. This is Forum President and CEO Brian Whalen. Forum Storytellers shares and preserves stories about life and work in the field of education abroad. I hope that you enjoy the stories featured in this podcast.
I'm Jim Citrin from World Fund and Dartmouth College, and I'm now here with good friend, mentor, colleague, inspiration in the field, Lily Engel, and it's such an honor to have the chance to interview you at this 12th annual Forum on Education Abroad conference here in Atlanta. I've known you for about 20 years.
Oh my goodness.
But something I don't know about you is how you got to be doing what you're doing. Did you study abroad yourself?
It's a good question because, in a way, I've been studying abroad all my life. Because, you know, my father was career military, an American soldier, and he met and married my Italian mother in Rome after the war. And so in my entire childhood, we were traveling constantly and living outside of the United States. So study abroad was basically having a military education, an American military education, outside of America. So in a way, it was very, very different, and I realized very early on as a child, in fact, my childhood memories are so much more vivid in the times that we lived. The military term is to live on the economy, meaning to live with the local population instead of living in the American barracks. And, I think the first time I studied abroad or lived abroad was when I was 4 years old. We moved to Germany and spent 4 or 5 years in Germany, and I learned to speak German and lived and played with the children in the little German streets. I won't tell you when. But, those were very important times. And then later in high school, I did all my high school years in Italy, and seeing the difference of being with the Italians and then the totally closed-off American community, really the notion of the American bubble within the Army compounds was really, it marked me in terms of how you can be in another country and not be there at all.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say, that my own stereotypical image of American military families abroad is that they're not living on the host culture's terms.
Yeah, so you create a parallel world, mm-hmm. No doubt. Mm. So, but did I actually ever do formal study abroad? Mm. No. I wanted to do the Peace Corps at one point in my 20s, but I already had a child. I had a child very young, and the Peace Corps wouldn't take me because I was a mother.
Oh, and that's changed a lot.
Yeah, it was one of my regrets, actually, in life. I felt committed to that.
So how did you get from there to doing what you're doing today?
It just kind of happens to you. I was at UCLA finishing graduate studies there. There was an exchange program with the University of Provence to be a lectrice, which would be like a teaching assistant. And my husband at the time, John Engel, and I applied, and we got to go to Aix-en-Provence to teach at the Aix-Marseille University. And so that was, we did that for a year, which was expanded into two. And I realized how absolutely horrible my culture shock was because we were not accompanied at all. I had this glorified vision of what it would be like to live in France, and I'd studied French literature and studied the French language. I didn't understand a word of listening to the news. I was wondering what in the world was going on in my classrooms at university. I couldn't even buy vegetables. I had no idea what cuts of meat or vegetables were like. But by being there, it really took us the second year to more or less adapt and understand the beauty of where we were. But that first year was just almost constant tears. We were living in an apartment which was much uglier. I imagine a little stone house with lace curtains and geraniums on the windowsill. And in fact, we had this miserable apartment with 1970s wallpaper and dilapidated furniture, and the dollar was really low at the time, and so we felt totally poor. But that second year is when I started teaching English for the French and started making a lot of contacts. So after we moved back to the States and then decided that we did not want to live in Illinois, where John had found a tenure-track job, we decided we would just start to look all over the world to move elsewhere. And so we did the real immigrant thing. It was both of us found jobs in Aix-en-Provence. And so we literally gave our house back to the bank. No one wanted to buy it. And we got our two children and 12 suitcases and moved to France. So we're just, you know, when my friends tell me, you know, well, who are you? I go, well, I'm an immigrant. And I've been living in France consistently since 1984. So that makes a nice fat 32 years.
Well, talk about a life-changing abroad experience.
That was a life-changing abroad experience. But I really realized in that, especially that first stay in Aix-en-Provence, it's a funny thing because actually the couple that went before us, the couple from UCLA that went before us, we were very jealous that they were chosen, and they were back at UCLA 3 weeks later. And I remembered, I said, you know, what are you doing here? I thought you were supposed to be an ex. You know, it was our dream to be there. And they said, we discovered very quickly that we could not live in the manner to which we'd become accustomed. And it was that realization that rigid expectations or attached to your old habits, what a limiting experience that is for your personal and professional life. And so when John and I then first arrived in X, and I had my moments of tears and desperations, I just would say, there's no possible way I'm going to buckle down and give up in that way.
That's what I was going to ask you, because getting out of your comfort zone, I think, by definition, is what happens when you go abroad, if you're prepared for it. But they obviously weren't prepared for it. You today are responsible for shaping hundreds and hundreds of students' abroad experiences. You said your first experience was filled with constant tears and desperation. Do you think those were necessary parts of the experience?
Well, it's a necessary part of the experience when it's unaccompanied. What the huge advantage that students have is it's an accompanied experience. I tell them that, you know, we can live, people, Americans and other nationalities, foreigners, can live in France for 30 years and never be invited into a French home. And because the French have their circles of friends that are very, very tight, their immediate family, their childhood friends, their close working colleagues, and that already takes up so much of their time that if you're on the fringes, you can never fit into their schedules. It took me years before I was invited to a French wedding. And here the students arrive, and they're met at the airport by their host families on our program. So they're in France, you know, for literally 2 seconds. And they're welcomed by a French family. These are incredible privileges, incredible insider privileges. So the idea is to make them aware of that, mm-hmm. so they can live it as that.
Because I think you do a great job of giving them incredible privileges but not coddling them at the same time.
Well, that's a whole big story, isn't it? But, you know, it's all of the theory that we've learned. You know, you were talking about how study abroad has become a profession and all of the research that is now in the field. You know, we know all about balancing challenge and support. And if we're not challenging the students, then they stay very happily and very comfortably in their little American bubble and are not going through all the dramatic but very rich and rewarding ups and downs. So, yeah, I think I've certainly tried to get a good balance of that. But we talk about it. I know that some people in the field don't like the word intervention, so I've started to call it an accompaniment. It's a process that is a very demanding process for young people, for anybody, and it needs to be accompanied. So the techniques evolve as the student experience evolves.
But do you think that accompaniment can provide the same quality of experiences that the tears and desperation led to in your case?
It depends on how deep the immersion is. Because, you know, again, you know, it's how you frame the experience for the students. I basically tell them in the beginning, if they're not having moments of tears and disappointments and frustrations and feeling misunderstood or not really understanding what's going on around them or not really knowing how to behave in a given situation, they're not having the experience that is really waiting for them. They're not having the richness of the experience. And that's what my commitment is to them, to let them, as best they can, have those moments.
How would you describe the education abroad field?
Oh my goodness, get ready for this one. It's a very problematic field. I think the education abroad field is a very problematic field, full of contradictions, and those contradictions undermine the effectiveness of the field. I think, and again, with all of the admiration that I have for countless people that work with such devotion in this field, I think real genuine efforts to realize the full potential of study abroad is undermined by a system of which we all are a part, and that is the corporatization that has infiltrated the American university system, and that this balancing act between seeing students as customers whose preferences need to be satisfied. I just read a beautiful quote in a book that says, the university no longer honors students as acolytes whose preferences need to be formed, but as customers whose preferences need to be satisfied. And that it undermines the role of the university. Certainly in study abroad, when the whole purpose is the encounter with difference, to my mind, it's the encounter with difference. It's not just the simple geographic enhancement in a glamorous way of the university classroom. Mm-hmm. But there's such greater potential to study abroad, and that initiative has to be supported. And there are not systems in place that support that effort. To put such emphasis on student evaluations for the survival of programs is to oblige programs to minimize risks. And the more you put students in contact with the other, the culturally different other, the more those risks increase, that they might be momentarily unhappy or have moments of frustration. And you can't debrief all of that for every single student before the semester is over. And when you get a bad evaluation from a student when they go back to their home campus, you cannot see another student from that campus for two or three semesters until that student's evaluation disappears at the bottom of the pile, because that's the primary way in which programs, the so-called quality of programs, is evaluated and controlled by home universities, who have just too many things to do to be able to evaluate all of them themselves.
I saw a great cartoon in the New Yorker a couple of weeks ago that people were checking into the front desk of a hotel, and the front desk clerk was saying, "And if there's anything we can do to make your stay more enjoyable, just rant about it all over the internet." That is what we're all subject to in any field where we're interacting with people.
You've got me at a sore subject for me. It's a very sore subject for me, because I really try to look at the larger picture and try to remember that study abroad is part of a system of higher education that has put so much weight on student evaluations. But there is research that has come out very, very, very recently that traces the decline of the effectiveness of our university system of American higher education directly linked to the moment that student evaluations were given weight. That plagiarism and cheating has doubled, that grades have increased while the average study hours have decreased dramatically, that now the students can go on to these wonderful online services and tame their professors into diminishing the workload and giving good grades. I just recently read that students can today in the university system get a 3.2 GPA with only studying 1 hour a day, 5 days a week, not seven. So, what do we do with study abroad?
In many ways,
I've always thought that study abroad, because we're taking students out of the American university system, in a sense, the primary purpose is to expose them to a world of difference. Why move them if you're not going to expose them to a world of difference? And so we can establish our own rules. And why we fail to do that as a field is beyond, because the opportunity is available to us. We can prepare them for the time abroad, saying, you know, your grades are going to be lower. You know, we won't calculate those into your overall GPA, but they will show up on their transcript. So don't be afraid to take on classes that might be challenging. There are many ways that we fall short, buy too easily into a system that puts a lot of constraints on the potential of the field.
Are there systems that we could put in place that could make it possible for the quality of the experiences to improve significantly?
Absolutely. And there's so much now about, you know, we're exposed everywhere, in every walk of life. We're exposed to systems that have one and all one single desire, and that is to sustain themselves, even though it's proven that what they're doing is not necessarily what they set out to do in the first place. So how do we affect change? I mean, there are people, great minds, who have talked about how we affect change. And they say that the systems are so big, they're immovable. But what we can do on an individual and in terms of study abroad, this means on a program to program or on an institutional level, is to create these pods, the pods that have integrity and that have a value system that they think are respectful and honoring of the potential of the kind of learning that can take place abroad. And I'm talking about, you know, real competency-based skills that are life skills, that are employable skills, that I think is the role of the university. If we do that, how can we do that? Language requirements. Foreign languages are on the decline, desperately on the decline, and yet research on from neurologists, from psychologists, from sociologists, from a whole range of research talks about the immeasurable benefits of learning a foreign language. It makes you smarter, your performance increases, your memory increases, you become more empathetic, you earn more money. Why has that somehow been marginalized when in fact what I've read is students don't want to take it because it's much too much of a long-term investment. So that means that students of their own initiative are not going to go into foreign language, but in an enlightened program or an enlightened university says, so you have to have 3 years of foreign language before you can graduate. I mean, look in Europe. In Europe, one foreign language is not sufficient. Students, and starting at a very young age, are made to grow up with at least two foreign languages. And it creates, I think, the agility of mind that the human being needs absolutely to survive and thrive in the global world that faces us. So that's one of the huge sore points. Modern Language Association just gave us statistics that only 8% of students study foreign language today. It was double that in 1960, and of that 8%, only 1 in 5 enrolls in an advanced level language class during their 4 years of undergraduate study. I'm shaking my head. You can't hear this.
That's good. You know, if we heard something rattling, that would be worse.
But what that does, look at how that changes the face of study abroad, because one of the huge advantages of study abroad, another thing research has shown, the students can achieve an intermediate level on a home campus. One of the wonderful jewels of study abroad is it can break that glass ceiling between intermediate and advanced and superior levels of proficiency. So we talk about curriculum integration. Well, start students to have them do the first 4 or 5 semesters on their home campus, and then really let study abroad be the finishing school for language. So that's just one small example.
You talked about pods within bigger programs. Can you expand on that?
As individuals, when we look at systems that are in place, the tendency is to throw up our hands and say, it's too big, I can't possibly change it. But if we think about small movements of like-minded people who know where they want to go, those are the pods that can create and then connect with other pods who have the same kind of, to create affiliations, who want to move in the same direction. And what that does is it constitutes another substitute network, so that when finally the system that is in place, it will one day implode one day American higher education is going to say, we are not fulfilling our contract. Okay, we're selling credentials instead of really cultivating life skills, marketable life skills. And there will be movements to change that. And when movements come to change that, then there have to be other existing structures ready to take its place. So it's part of organic evolution, and study abroad has the unique role in American higher education to spearhead that.
Because you've got, on one hand, the ideals that got us into the field, that got both you and me and so many others into the field, and then, on the other hand, the pressure to mass produce the experience for others, and something's going to have to give, but maybe...
But then again, you know, there. If we evaluate it from afar, from distance, the field isn't in crisis. The numbers are going up.
Evaluations are getting better.
we don't seem to be worried about the proliferation of short-term programs, proliferation of English language speaking programs. It's getting more and more students to go abroad more easily, but and if we think that pure numbers are good in and of themselves, that becomes the dominant value system. And a system will always adhere to the dominant value system.
Or the lowest common denominator, which may be the same thing.
So it's a problematic fit.
So what motivates your work in education abroad?
Well, that's a good question. You gave me the right question. My work in study abroad has been, from the onset, very intentional. Before I actively got involved in study abroad, I observed study abroad for 8 years. In Aix-en-Provence, there are a number of study abroad programs, and I really saw how students lived their abroad experience. And it's a lot of what we were talking about earlier, the speaking English all the time, being in their bubble world. I saw lots of beer bars pop up and fast food joints pop up along the pathways that the students would walk. So, in fact, the student presence... the foreign or American student presence in a small town like Aix-en-Provence changed the city, I think, more than the city changed the students. And when I saw that happening, and you know, it was more John Engel, my then husband, who was involved in study abroad, who became so frustrated. His comment was, "I feel like the only thing I'm doing is moving bodies around." And I had language school. I had a language school that I had founded 8 years earlier. And I said, well, you know, we have a language school here. We can try to implement a vision of study abroad that can really prove to the profession just how good one semester abroad can be. And that good, you know, we define that good as basically how much French proficiency could a student acquire in a semester abroad, and to what extent could they develop their intercultural skills. And so experimented with that for the first few years, did everything wrong, had lots of disappointments, realized where all the weak points were. But once I discovered the IDI as well, the Milton Bennett's developmental model of intercultural sensitivity, it gave me a sort of a pathway. I knew where the students were and where I wanted to take them. And so developing an appropriate program design became very easy. So it became very intentional. We really, with independent testing, just wanted to prove to the field that, I mean, I'm not a miracle worker, nobody's a miracle worker, but with just the right kind of accompaniment, the right kind of information, dosed at the right time, students with their inherent desire to do well and to find a broader space for themselves in the world, you just capitalize on that, and they can go very, very, very far. So I've always tried to protect myself from, you know, not labeling them as millennial students or this and that. They're just young people that have tremendous potential and are very malleable. And as long as you know what you're doing, and as long as you can inspire complicity instead of imposing compliance, they can go very, very far.
So what's been the proudest moment of your career in education abroad?
I have two answers to that. Is that cheating? My proudest moment was when Brian Whelan asked me to give the keynote speech in Chicago. I felt very honored. In fact, I couldn't believe that he'd asked me to do that. I don't think an insider from the field had been ever asked to do that before, and I felt very honored to do that. But I've had many, many other more, how can you say, moments of a real feeling of victory and accomplishment. And strangely enough, it's much after the student experience, because the fact that I'm an exemple of all students love to come back, and now generations, not for, but for the past 22 years now, they're, you know, some of them are in their 40s, they come back and they introduce me to their husbands and wives. And those husbands and wives are very often French. And the what I find fascinating is not so much my student story, but the story of the spouse. And what this, the pattern that has emerged is they meet in America. They don't meet in France. They meet in America. And this French person, usually a man, okay, because of the dominant population is female presence abroad, they'll be there feeling like a foreigner in America, and they meet this young American girl who has lived in their country, and not only has lived in their country, but understands their culture. And they say to me, I can almost, you know, map out the words, she really understood, or she really understands who I am. And that was such, that to them is such an immediate form of bonding and complicity to have their own personal complexity understood, that it's just a lovely foundation for love and companionship and passion in life. So each one of those stories just fills my heart with joy to know that this whole bridging that we want to see accomplished in the world, bridging across difference, happens on a very individual level. And if we do it over and over and over again, gradually it will infect the entire world.
I think those two stories and a lot of other things we talked about really sums up why I respect you so much as a colleague and a mentor in this field, and that is that you combine heart with brains and a real sense of intentionality in everything you do. And that's not as common as one might think it is in this field. So
you're very sweet, and thank you. Thank you for saying that. I think there are many, many people like me out there, but I have the privilege of working for myself to a very large extent. And many others who are in proximity to the student experience abroad don't have the funding or the time to conduct their own research, to travel as often to conferences like Forum or NAFSA or others to let their voices be heard. But there are many inspired people out there who see how we could be doing things better, but maybe have a little less control. I've created a very privileged position for myself in that I can control the learning environment of my students, whereas many of my colleagues, and I know them better and better, at least in France, have those conditions imposed upon them by people who are distant from the student experience. And that creates a tremendous and unproductive disconnect.
And I think maybe it's because you're from the field that your plenary address was so impactful and so memorable to so many of us. And I think on behalf of so many people in the field, I just close by thanking you for being the inspiration that you have been to so many of us.
Thank you so much, Jim.
On the next Forum Storytellers podcast.
For the first time, I heard the fresh and authentic voice of the experience of American students abroad, and you brought that to the field before anyone else.